On the transportation board, a light blinked twice and then went red. Kyle looked at the code twice, then looked at his supervisor, Della Part, who was trying to listen in on a conversation between an RSS security advisor and her own supervisor.
Baby train's got a problem.
The yearly field trip had its own code name, which the school knew nothing about.
What kind of problem?
Don't know yet.
Kyle hit the comm button.
Transgraph 4, what's your problem?
No answer. Any problem that could pull a Transgrav tram driver off his seat might really call for help. If one of the kids had been hurt... Across the control room, Sash looked up from his environmental board.
What compartment's baby train in?
Heavy cargo, too.
I've got a slight but significant rise in PCO2, and ambient temp's up slightly.
Kids got loose? Running around?
Where's our video?
Blank. It's been blinky the last few days.
Ask station security.
Security.
We got a problem in heavy cargo, too. What have you got on scan?
Let me see. CO2's up a bit, O2 consumption's up. Also ambient temp, visual. The transgrav stopped at the station. Wasn't baby train on for today?
Yeah, they've popped to red and I can't raise them.
Yeah, it looks normal. Cargo containers coming in from Free Dawn 24. Cargo handlers... Wait, what color is heavy cargo this year?
Orange. Changed from tan.
Would anyone be an old... Oh, shit.
What?
None of the heavy cargo crews would be carrying firearms. We have an intrusion.
In there? What about the kids? We have a level 5 emergency. Hostile intruders in heavy cargo 2 and a trainload of kids. That preschool field trip.
The RSS officer opened his mouth and shut it again, but looked sideways at the supervisor.
Cut out the alarms to that sector. Put us on level 5 alert. Patch to the station master and the emergency response teams. Call in the second shift as backup.
Della glanced back at the RSS officer.
What else?
How many certified emergency personnel do you have?
Counting security, medical, damage control, maybe 500.
Find out. You need to know exactly. And I recommend you inform the picket as well. We can presume this intrusion is of foreign origin.
Station master will have to approve.
I do.
Kyle was relieved to hear the station master's voice over the comm.
Can they help?
Maybe. Then recall all RSS personnel on station and collect them. Check MSOs, specialties for security, demolitions, and emergency medical.
Sergeant Cavallo had chosen to finish out his present tour in mess, in part because the supply and mess personnel had more chance of a few hours on stations during otherwise boring picket duty. The weekly green run always meant 24 hours on station, and sometimes more. He liked the bustle of the markets. He had, thanks to his grandmother's gardening passion, an unusually good eye for quality produce. He knew that Purcell's Family Grocers sometimes imported fresh fruits from planetside groves and hoped to find either cherries or cheroons. The exec's 10th anniversary was coming up, and he liked cherries. The other part was his sense of the ridiculous. Few, if any, neuro-enhanced troops ever had the chance to indulge a harmless interest. He was only 5 minutes from the station when a red light came up on the board. The shuttle pilot grimaced and switched channels. Cavallo saw the telltale hardening of the jaw, then the pilot's hands moving to change settings on the board.
What?
They've got an intrusion. They don't know what, but armed hostiles in heavy cargo, and they've taken hostages... A whole tramload of preschool kids.
Cavallo wanted to ask what a tramload of preschoolers had been doing in heavy cargo's 0.25G, but that wasn't the most urgent question.
Who they got with anti-terrorist experience?
I don't know, but they've got a Major Reichart on station, and he's ordered all fleet personnel to assemble. That's why we're shifting dock assignment. Sorry, Sarge, but it looks like we're all part of this for the duration.
Cavallo was suddenly aware of the irony of his present position. He had chosen mess duty as a welcome break from the tedium of being a special response team leader on a picket ship where nothing happened. And here he was, back in his own territory, but without any of his equipment or a trained team.
Better let the major know I'm coming in.
The pilot shot him a quick glance.
You, Sarge? But you're a cook.
The pilot had known Cavallo only in his present duty. Perhaps he thought the extra bulk was a supply sergeant's overindulgence.
Not entirely. My primary specialty is NEM's special response.
The pilot looked nervous. The usual reaction in someone discovering that he was sitting next to one of the few fleet personnel trained to kill in hand-to-hand combat.
You're a NEM?
Yep, so call me in.
Yes, sir.
Although the supply shuttle had not been fitted out with a combat mission in mind, all fleet shuttles carried some basic emergency equipment. There was no combat armor to fit Cavallo, but he grabbed the largest pea suit and the ready pack of demolition supplies, intended to create a small hull breach if that should be necessary in an emergency. 3 bricks of LUB explosive, 5 standard fusing options, and the components for others, detonation signalers. He checked it all, and by the time the shuttle docked, he had repacked it and was ready to dive out the tube. Sarknon Filios had been celebrating the successful auction of his old ship, the Mindy Cricket II, and the sale of his interest in the minerals they'd towed in. His crew had joined the celebration as well. While they hadn't quite drained the Spacer's Delight dry, they'd made its proprietor richer, and as the morning commuters rushed past, Sarknon was finally ready for bed. Bed was 2 stops away on the station tram. He gathered his crew and led them across to the tram stop. There, a man in security green demanded their IDs, even though they wore their ship suits with patches prominent on the left shoulder.
What is it, man? We've been in the Delight. You must have seen us cross it over. We ship screw. We bother nobody.
Your IDs, sir.
Station security normally went unarmed, but this one carried an acoustic weapon slung over his shoulder. Down the platform, Sarknon could see 2 more security men now looking this way. Annoyed though he was, Sarknon didn't intend to cause trouble. He fumbled in his ship suit's pocket and brought out his ID folder. Sarknon stood, swaying slightly, as the man glanced from his papers to his face, again and again, and finally had had enough.
Footland shame, I say. Leaping on folks just as ship's crew come to spend money at the station. Isn't enough to let yon pubkeeper charge twice as much for his wares? Now you have to act as if you don't know who we are.
The man closed the folder and handed it back.
Take it easy. We've got trouble. We're looking for rock hoppers with demolitions experience. Looks like you're it.
A contract? I can't talk contract now. Next shift, maybe, when the drinks left me.
Now.
The other two had come nearer, without Sarknon noticing, and now he found himself facing drawn weapons.
Trouble, Harv?
Nope. Found us a demo crew, but they're soused. Help me get them to medical.
I'm not going to med. It'll just waste my money. I've earned that drunk. It's mine.
When he woke again, he was on a cot in the station medical clinic, and he woke entirely in an instant with the unnatural clarity of the detox patient.
Damn it. And I bought a whole jug of that Cernian ale.
A young woman slid a needle out of his vein.
Never mind. You save those kids, and I will personally buy you 2 jugs.
Sarknon sat up, not regretting the headache he didn't have, thanks to detox, and looked around for his crew.
Well then, if it's that kind of job...
It's that kind of job.
Sarknon didn't recognize the man's uniform, but the tone of voice was unmistakable. Sarknon followed him along the corridor to a compartment full of people in EMS vests, and 5 minutes later, he was explaining all he knew about demolition. Instead of the organized, disciplined planning groups Cavallo was used to, a room full of civilians were gathered into smaller groups that didn't appear to be working together. Cavallo spotted the major at once and made his way over.
Sergeant Cavallo, sir. NEM Special Response Team.
That's good news. How many of you?
Just me, sir. I was inbound on a supply run. I've been acting as supply sergeant for the picket boat.
A NEM supply sergeant? No, don't tell me. Later, when we have time, we have a very bad situation here.
Quickly, the major laid it out. The intruders, the preschool field trip, the information he had so far on station resources.
They don't have anything equivalent to your training. Good basic emergency services, but nothing to handle large-scale terrorist actions. They'd been warned, but they didn't really know where to get the information they needed. That's why I was here. And those kids are really our problem now. The med staff has told me that they're more susceptible to sudden pressure changes than adults. They get shock lung more easily, and it's harder to treat. Same is true of chemical riot control agents or the acoustics. We're going to end up hurting kids no matter what we do, so we have to be very, very fast.
Negotiation, sir.
The Major shrugged, with an expression Cavallo couldn't quite read.
I've got the usual complement of mental health professionals, and two of them have some experience in small-scale stuff. Man holding his ex-wife hostage and threatening the kids, that sort of thing. But nobody with this kind of experience, and I'm not sure they realize how different it is. I suspect that our bad guys wouldn't talk to a fleet officer, and as you can tell, I have an accent that won't quit.
Those new Texas guys?
Don't know yet. So far, we have no contact. The station master cut all comm right away. I've been unable to convince him to reopen at least one line. He's afraid they'll override the security precautions to the main computers, I think.
We can fix that, sir. I brought the demolitions and communication kits from the shuttle.
Good man. Let me get you to the station master.
If they want to kill the children, to make a statement or something, the kids are as good as dead, if they aren't already. We can't prevent it. What we can do is talk to them. Our sources tell us they have very strong family connections, especially to their children. We can hope they are less likely to kill children, more likely to negotiate where children are concerned.
But they think our children are heathens.
Yes, but they didn't hurt the children from the Elias Madero. They wanted to save them. They aren't likely to have planned this for the one day of the year the preschool has a field trip.
Cavallo's Iranian accent had amused his fleet associates at first. After 20-some years, he could turn it on and off like a tap. His implants helped. But at the moment, it might be useful.
Anybody there?
Who are you?
I'm looking for that teacher, Sarah Soren. We're worried about those children.
What children?
Those children in the tram. It's time they was home, don't you think?
What do you mean, having children in a transgrav tram? Don't you care about them?
Of course we care. That's why I'm calling. Can I talk to the teacher, please?
No, you can't talk to her. She's doing what she's told, keeping them chilling quiet.
But they're all right. I mean, you know kids. They need the bathroom when they get hungry and thirsty. You got enough snacks for them?
No, we don't got food for kids. You're a kid down here, mister?
Cavallo had considered trying to impersonate a parent, but kids that age couldn't be fooled easily. If he claimed to be some boy's father and the boy said, "That's not my dad," they'd be worse off than they were now.
No, not mine. But it might as well be. Children are everyone's responsibility where I come from.
And where's that?
Irene.
Oh.
Cavallo wished he'd been able to get a vid tap. Facial expressions would tell him a lot. But the vid pickup was snaking its way through the utility lines, a good 70 meters from Heavy Cargo 2.
Well, it's too bad about the kids, but...
I can get you supplies for him. Food and water. For you too.
As if that last were a new thought rather than an orchestrated tactic.
Listen, you, whoever you are.
Cavallo chose an uncle's name at random.
Fred. Fred Vallo.
Well, Fred, the thing is, these children are dead if we want them to be.
I understand that.
So you better give us what we want.
If the children die, none of you will get off this station alive.
If you want them alive, you do what we tell you.
But we can't kill children.
Cavallo smiled to himself. Trouble in the enemy camp, and talking to a negotiator. They had already lost. If only small children hadn't been involved.
I need to speak to someone who can assure me that the children are unharmed. If not the teacher, one of the other adults on the tram.
Wait.
Cavallo muted his mic and turned to the major.
You heard, sir? There's at least one who's going to cause their leader trouble if he hurts the children. And so far, they're willing to talk.
Yes, but how long will it last? Wonder if he'll really let you talk to one of the adults.
The light blinked on his set, and he turned the mic back on.
Go on. Tell them the children aren't hurt.
But they want to use the toilet.
Tell them.
This is Parkop Kinderson with the Little Lambs field trip. You know about that?
Yes, Sir Kinderson. Are the children unharmed?
Well, they aren't hurt, but they're scared. Especially Bri, because he saw his father get hit, and they need to use the toilets, and they won't let us. And they're getting hungry, and they won't let us get them anything at the tram station snack bar.
Enough! You know this Kinderson fella?
Not personally, no.
Cavallo had skimmed a file on all the adults with the field trip and knew that Kinderson was a single parent, taking a day off his job as a coder for the housing authority to help chaperone the children.
Seems kind of excitable. Not like a normal man.
He's worried about the children. So am I. How about if we arrange some snacks for him? Or carry pots so they can use the toilet right on the tram.
The tram has toilets?
No, that's why I said carry pots. Families have them here to take along with a small child if there's not a toilet around.
There's toilets in the tram station, though, aren't there?
Sure, but you don't want to let them off the train. They're little children. I'm sure you know about them and how they run around getting into things. It's smart of you to keep them safe in one place.
We want to talk to our women.
Your women?
Hey, don't pretend you don't know. Those rangers' wives you stole, and they're chilling. We want to tell them to get themselves home.
Just a second.
Cavallo blanked the mic and gestured to the station master.
Are there any of those New Tech's women at this station?
No, they left a while back. Why?
Because these fellas came to take them home, that's why. Do you know where they went?
No. I can look on the passenger lists, but that'll only tell me which ship.
Which we don't want to tell these guys.
Cavallo flipped the mic back on.
I just asked the station master, and he says they aren't here. They were, but they left a while back.
You're lying! You get us our children, or we'll take yours!
I can get you a list.
Cavallo waved, and the station master came back over.
We need a list or something, so these men know those women aren't here.
There's a directory accessible from the public data ports in heavy cargo, but we cut the lines.
We'll put in a shielded line.
We're gonna blow this whole place if you don't give us our women and children!
Now, just a minute. We don't none of us want children hurt. Let's see what we can figure out here.
Someone held a display screen in front of him with the message, data display at tram station active for our use.
It's true your children aren't here anymore, and it's true I don't know where they are. You, what'd you say your name was?
Dan. You can call me Dan.
Dan, I reckon you think children should be with their parents.
Yeah, that's right. So if our children ain't here, we want to know where they've gone.
The vidscan was in, though distorted by the wide-angle lens. Scan specialists ran tests, converting the image to a correct 3D version. Cavallo made himself ignore that until they were done, and someone moved a screen close to him so he could see it. Now, when Dan spoke, he could see the computer's best guess at the face. Middle-aged, as he'd guessed, the face of someone who had taken difficult responsibility before.
How'd you plan to get him away?
Steal a ship. We done it before.
Good plan.
Cavallo mentally crossed his fingers and scribbled, "Find a small, cheap, simple ship" on the pad and handed it to the Major.
We could just take these children instead if ours is really gone.
But it's not the same, and these children should be with their families.
You offering to let us go?
Would you?
Might.
Cavallo watched the man put down the mic and turn away, talking to the others. He boosted the audio pickup.
You said they was here.
That's the best word we had.
I tell you, I'm getting sick of this. We come all the way from home, working like dogs on that damn ship because you didn't want to spend the money for tickets, which would have been worth it if we'd killed the old buzzard, but we didn't on account of somebody else beat us to the damn draw.
Wasn't supposed to take that long.
And who picked out that ship? Then you say let's get those kids back, and they ain't even our kids. And we have to work our passage again coming here, and when we get here, they ain't here. I don't know as I believe they ever have been here.
Everybody in that bar said they was.
Everybody in that bar was drunk, Dan. They ain't here, and they ain't been here. And what in Sam Hill are we gonna do now?
I'll think of something. Just give me a minute, will you?
Oh, we could take these kids.
Hell, I don't want these kids. These ain't our kids or Ranger kids. And what'd we take them in, anyway?
Well, what do you want to do? Give up and let them kill us like they did them Rangers?
We ain't done nothing yet they'd kill us for.
I ain't surrendering nothing.
Well, I'm not killing any chillin. Why don't we trade them for a ship out of here?
A whole ship? You think godless heathen would give us a whole ship for just a bunch of chillin? They don't care about chillin.
How's it going?
Cavallo sat back, still watching the vid.
They're fighting over whose fault it is. If I understand them right, this bunch wanted to assassinate Lord Thornbuckle. When they found out someone else had, they decided to hunt up the women and children and capture them. I don't think they're New Tech's Rangers. I think they're a bunch of idealistic fools that went off by themselves.
Cavallo tapped the mic, and heads turned in the vid. Dan came over, almost reluctantly, to pick it up.
Dan! Dan! Listen! Are the children still all right?
Yeah, they're fine for now.
Dan, the station master tells me the women and children left 11 days ago on a passenger ship, the Dolphin Rider.
On the vid, two of the other men threw up their hands, and one spat on the deck.
Now, I can't change that, Dan, but here's what I could do.
What?
I don't know if you... I mean, if we could get you a ship, Dan, and then the children wouldn't get hurt.
You mean trade the chillens for a ship? You'd do that?
Yeah, of course. It's children we're talking about.
A whole ship. A ship that actually works.
Of course.
Cavallo glanced up as someone leaned over and handed him a pad with Mindy Cricket 2 scrawled on it.
I don't know. We'd need supplies.
Cavallo dared a grin at the Major as he flicked the mic off.
They're gonna take it. Now, if they don't cross us, and there's some of them I'm pretty sure won't, Where's that ship docked?
It had taken another 12 hours of ticklish negotiation before the children were reunited with frantic parents, the New Tech's terrorists were finally aboard the Mindy Cricket 2, and the little ship lurched away from the station with her usual grace.
You didn't really have to do anything. She's not going to get them anyplace real fast.
Especially not now.
Cavallo had applied the bricks of LUB to best advantage. Mindy Cricket 2 wouldn't make it to jump distance in one piece. 2 hours out, a safe distance from the station, and she'd blow.
We don't need that kind of scum wandering around causing trouble.
Cavallo stretched and grinned at the Major.
Guess I'll go finish the shopping now, if it's all the same to you.
Jake Serrano to the captain's office.
Baron tapped his code into the wall-hung unit to signal his receipt of the message and turned to the sergeant of the compartment.
I'll finish this inspection later, and I'll expect you'll have done something about those lockers.
The lockers had been unlocked, and Baron had already found 3 major discrepancies.
Yes, sir.
All the way up ship, Baron wondered what he'd done. He couldn't think of anything, and Major Conway had actually complimented him the day before. Captain Escobar's clerk gave him no warning glances, just smiled and waved him through. Baron came to attention and waited. Escobar handed a data cube across to him.
I thought you'd like to know you have pay.
Sir?
Apparently your dependents have found honest work somewhere. They're all fleet hands.
Where are they?
Some colony world. Apparently Professor Meyerson and that Lone Star Confederation diplomat found them a place. And someone paid their colony shares. Also paid off at least part of what fleet spent on them. And HQ has forgiven the rest. So you have pay again. I suppose this means you'll be marrying.
I hope so, sir.
From one fire into another. Better give your family time to get used to it. Have your parents ever met Lieutenant Sweezer?
No, sir. But now that I'm getting pay again, if I could get a little leave...
You'd get married.
No, sir, not right away. I'd get her together with my parents, though.
You have plenty of leave stacked up. Tell you what, figure out a time that will work for your parents and her, and I'll do my best.
You have mail, Lieutenant.
What is it this time?
Esme's last mail had been a stiff notice from personnel advising her that she should have informed them before accepting appointment as a land bride, and that any request for a variance would have to work its way through the chain of command in her sector, then at headquarters. A cube from Baron. That had to be better than something from personnel. Her heart soared as she read it. Out from under the responsibility for all those women and children, getting paid again. He'd talk to his parents. They wanted to meet her. He could get leave. What about her? He was sure he could enlist the senior Serranos to aid in bending the restrictions about land brides. She, too, had accumulated leave time. Surely it would be possible to meet for a few days, even a week. Somewhere private. She didn't mind meeting his parents, but she wanted at least some hours alone with Baron. Although Fleet's Copper Mountain training base, named for the Red Rock formation of the original landfall, had become the generic term for the entire planet, Fleet had other bases where neither mountains nor red dust were in view. Most NCO training courses, though reached by shuttle from Copper Mountain, were actually dispersed to other facilities on the same continent. Drylands in the northern plains, Camp Engleton in the coastal swamp, Big Trees far to the west. Permanently assigned school staff had their own recreational areas, which students never saw. The long sand beaches far east of Copper Mountain, where the carnivorous hunters of the deep had been carefully fenced away. Eight Peaks Mountain District, which offered far more than 8 peaks, though the rest of them weren't quite 8,000 meters. Among these lesser-known bases were the Stack Islands facilities. Rising almost vertically from the cold waters of what someone had unimaginatively called Big Ocean, the old volcanic plugs of the stacks had been engineered into even more forbidding shapes than time, wind, and water had created. The Stack Islands group had 3 fleet bases altogether, 2 for research, biomedical and weapons, and 1 to supervise the confinement of its most dangerous criminals. That proximity was no accident. Although the Grand Council knew nothing about it, Research into neurobiology used prisoner subjects, some of whom emerged from the program with new identities. But the proximity was on a planetary, not local, scale. Though less than an hour by air car to either of the other Stack Islands bases, the prison was distant enough to keep its prisoners secure. The research bases were only a few kilometers apart on neighboring stacks, but the prison base lay at the east end of the group, out of sight from either and far beyond swimming distance, even if water temperature and sea life had not intervened. The security personnel at Three Stack, as the prison base was colloquially called, made no attempt to prevent prisoners from committing suicide. It was the general feeling that suicides saved everyone a lot of trouble. So little attention was paid to preventing escape attempts that were certain to be fatal. Prisoners could jump off the cliffs into the cold water if they felt like it. If they survived the fall and the numbing cold, they were easy prey for the native sea life, which in these latitudes was toothy and voracious. Although guards patrolled the corridors and exercise courts, and the base's air cars were carefully guarded, no regular watch was kept on the cliffs. Commanding such a base did nothing to advance an officer's career, and most loathed brig duty. For a few, however, Stack Islands Base 3 offered exactly the milieu in which they flourished. Corporal Gellin Mahari, second shift guard at Three Stack, wondered what it was about his new commander that bothered him. Prison COs were invariably bent in some way. Tolan had been soft, slovenly, entirely too fond of his own comfort, and easily handled by the senior NCOs. But this Bakarian person was clearly not bent that way.
What did she do to get sent here?
A tour at a high-security brig was no disgrace to the enlisted security force, rather the contrary, if nothing went wrong. But he had an uneasy feeling about her. After the change of command ceremony, his immediate superior, Sergeant Copans, dismissed the second shift to eat and prepare for their shift. Gellin racked his ceremonial staff and changed from his dress to his duty uniform. As always, he made sure that his gear was perfectly aligned in his locker before heading for the mess hall. Then he checked his bay in the barracks. Sure as vacuum, that new commander would pull an inspection, and he intended his unit to pass. On the way to mess, he stopped by the base data center and called up the officers' list. At least he could find out about his new commander's official biography. Her image on the screen showed her with the insignia of a lieutenant commander. She hadn't had her image updated since her last promotion. He scanned the notes below. Top quartile in the academy, so she wasn't stupid. Command track with her junior duty on a series of frontline craft. As a major, she'd done the usual rotation in staff, this time on a flagship, the Dominion. There, she'd seen combat, though from the staff viewpoint.
What is it about Dominion? I should know that name.
Gellin scrolled to the flag's name.
Lepescu. Bakarian was on Lepescu's staff?
Gellin clamped his jaw, hoping his expression had not changed. Years before, Admiral Lepescu had ordered a ship commanded by Harris Serrano into an engagement that meant certain death for her crew with little or no tactical gain. Serrano refused to follow the Admiral's orders and won the battle, but lost her command. Thanks to Lepescu, Serrano's crew, including his oldest living sib, Methlin, had been tried and imprisoned.
Bakarian deserves a prison appointment. Hell, she probably deserves to be a prisoner.
He switched off the unit, smiled a careful smile at the clerk in charge, and went to lunch with a gnawing pain in his belly. Partway through the meal, he stopped eating abruptly, with his fork halfway to his mouth.
What if this isn't punishment for Bakarian? What if she wanted this assignment? What if she wants to play games with prisoners like Lepescu did?
Gellin was going to have to be very careful indeed. When she noticed that she had a Mahari aboard, she was going to assume he knew, and knew she knew. When nothing happened during the first few weeks of Bakarian's command, Gellin did not relax his vigilance. He asked no questions. He said nothing he had not said many times before. He continued to be, to all outward signs, the same quietly competent young NCO he had been all along. Inside, he felt himself caught in a storm. What Bakarian had done so far was call in each officer and NCO in turn from the most senior down. Each had returned from that interview looking thoughtful. A few had also looked puzzled or worried. None had had more comment than that she was a tough lady. His turn with Bakarian would come soon. She had access to his service record, which included a list of all relatives formerly or presently in service.
What will she say? What will she ask? What should I say? I want you dead like Lepescu? That obviously won't do.
Finally, Gellin's turn came, and he found himself in the commanding officer's reception area. Tolan had not been a slob, but Bakarian's offices already looked shinier, neater. Everything gleamed, smudgeless. Every paper on the clerk's desk aligned perfectly with every other.
A martinet, like Lepescu.
In the inner office, Bakarian waited, sitting motionless behind her desk, like a carved figurine.
Corporal Meharry, reporting as ordered, sir.
It was hard not to react when her cold gaze met his.
You don't look much like your sister. Why is it the men in a family so often get the looks, I wonder?
Gellin felt his neck go hot, then the flush spreading up his face. Her smile warmed.
Sorry, Corporal. Didn't mean to embarrass you.
Yeah, right.
Gellin hoped that looking like a silly boy was the best strategy now.
I met her only a few times, of course. I was shocked and surprised when I heard she'd been sentenced to prison, and delighted when her name was cleared again.
A wrinkle appeared in her forehead. Gellin was sure it was intentional, intended as a sign of sincerity.
It may be hard for you to believe, Corporal, but when I was serving on Admiral Lepescu's staff, I had no idea he was capable of any dishonesty. He seemed so focused on defeating the enemy.
That was one way of putting it. If you ignored the fact that Lepescu's allies paid the price of his focus as well as the enemy, the fact that he liked seeing bloodshed in quantity, and didn't much care whose it was. Bakarian was frowning now, slightly, as if he'd failed to carry out some order.
I hope we can work together.
Yes, sir.
Bakarian's face relaxed, but whether that was good or bad, he could not tell.
Did you request assignment here because your sister had been here?
Gellin had anticipated this question.
No, sir. Personnel noticed I hadn't had a tour in my secondary specialty and yanked me off Flashpoint right before deployment. I asked for Sector 3, so I'd at least be in the same sector as the ship, but they sent me here.
Do you find it difficult?
No, sir.
What do you think of the general loyalty of the officers and men on the station?
Loyalty? I'm not sure I know what the commander is asking about.
Don't play innocent, Meharry. Anytime you have prisoners and guards, you have the possibility of collusion, even a breakout. I'm asking you if you know anything about such a situation here.
No, sir. Nothing like that.
Bakarian gave him another searching look.
Very well. Dismissed.
The autumn evening was closing in, a fine cold mist blowing across the courtyard. Gellin shivered. It was a week yet until time to change to winter uniforms, but it wasn't the outward cold that chilled him. The 10 kilometers to Stack 2 and 12 to Stack 1 might as well have been the thousands of kilometers that stretched to the next continental mass for all the good it did him. He could not pilot any of the air cars, even if the air cars had not been kept under close guard. There were no surface watercraft. The stacks had no beaches or harbors where such craft could land. Water met rock with brutal suddenness, 20 meters below the lowest accessible path. In storms, the spray of that meeting shot upward 30 and 40 meters. He could swim, but he could not swim 10 kilometers in water that cold, even if the sea creatures didn't eat him.
No escape.
He was trapped as surely as any of the prisoners. Gellin had no doubt that Bakarian would try to have him killed, and in such a way that it required the least investigation, which meant probably not shooting or stabbing or even a fatal blow to the head, any of which would require sending his body for forensic examination. She might or might not have a collaborator in the medical facility on Stack 1. Though such a murder could be blamed on a prisoner, far more useful for her purposes would be a disappearance, something that would leave the blame on him. If he went AWOL, as he had been thinking of doing, he realized with a start, Bakarian would be free to make up whatever story she liked about him. The most likely thing was a quick toss over the cliff, alive or dead. Alive, probably, because then Bakarian's agents could honestly claim not to have harmed him. She would not order an attack until she was sure it would succeed. Until she was sure she had enough support. He had a little time to make his preparations, minimal though they could be. Three Stack had 50 personal protective units, planetary, in storage. In theory, a PPU would protect its wearer from the rigors of a planetary climate, as well as a variety of traumas. Abstracting a personal protective unit from stores would definitely attract attention, but they were inventoried only once a month.
Will the attack come in that time? Probably.
But a PPU wouldn't be enough to keep him alive in the ocean. He needed something else. Aircraft carried survival gear. They did occasionally come down in the ocean, and the crew did occasionally survive to use the life rafts and other gear. There was a manual, he had seen a copy once, on surviving such wrecks, modified from one written by people who liked to sail around in boats. But he had read the manual out of boredom while waiting for a shuttle flight, and with the casual contempt of someone who would never be stupid enough to get himself in a situation where the details presented would be important. Methlin had always said, learn everything you can. Meth had survived worse.
Why do big sisters have to be right so often?
Spare survival gear for the aircraft based at Three Stack was stored in a locked bay on the shore side of the hangar. In his first month on station, he had been part of the inventory team that preceded the annual IG inspection. He remembered clearly the fat bundles, like sausage lumps, that were stacked next to the outer wall. Heavy, awkward, and not something he could tuck under his arm.
So, where can I stash something like that?
Before he took it, he had to have a place to hide it, and he spent the next few off-shifts looking. Everywhere on the limited surface of the stack, someone else had reason to be. The two main lava tubes were in regular use. One had a small lift tube fitted into it. Personnel were up and down several times a day, though most didn't venture beyond the stacks of reserve supplies piled at the foot, and the little nest of discarded clothing just around the corner, where those who wanted to keep their encounters private bedded down in the warmer months.
Still, it's the only place.
The smaller of the tubes opened to the outside, above the high tide level except in storms. Generations of guards had broken a connection between the two. He was not the only one who had stood in the sea opening watching the waves at closer range, and even trying to catch one of the native sea creatures on a molly line. As long as no one saw him actually dragging a deflated life raft into the sea cave, his presence in the tubes would cause no notice. He hoped. He felt clever about figuring out a way to get the folded raft through the buildings and into the lift tube without detection. He didn't have to take it himself. He'd stenciled it with a supply code and simply told a pivot to take it down with other supplies when the next load came in. Supply drops were chaotic enough that no one noticed, or seemed to, when an extra container went down. Later, he found it, and, having borrowed an AG dolly, floated it down the tube, through the gap, and to his chosen hiding place. He felt better after that, even though his chances were still, he felt sure, closer to zero than 100. At least he had a chance, if a small one. Once that was done, Gellin's mind turned to Bakarian's plans, not his own.
What is she up to?
He was as sure as if he'd crawled into her head that she had sought this assignment, but he could see no reason why. She would not have come here because of him. Surely revenge on Methlin Mahari's little brother wasn't profit enough for 3 years on Stack 3. He needed to find out what Bakarian was planning and report it, if he could figure out how. He was not in Bakarian's confidence, and he had no access to the administrative offices anyway. That would just get him killed faster. As the days passed, Gellin found that acting normal stretched his nerves almost past bearing. Inspections, chores, guard duty, wondering which of the guards and which of the prisoners were in on the plan, and yet again what the plan was. If only he knew what was going on. But although it became increasingly obvious that something was, that he was being left out of meetings and plans, he could not find anything out. He had not considered himself a trusting soul, but now, trying to trust no one, He realized that he had the normal human desire to be part of a group, not a complete outsider. Margu Pardalt had accepted a position as junior instructor in the schools and discovered that she enjoyed teaching. As the weather eased, bringing the occasional cool breath from the far north, her spirits lifted. Xavier had never been quite as hot as Copper Mountain in summer, and she looked forward to winter here. Unlike some of the others, who never took to planetside life, she enjoyed learning more about the world she was on. Her first chance to travel came in the break between class sessions, and she didn't even have to use leave time. Priority directives of very high classification had to be hand-carried from base to base. Ensign Pardalt was the obvious choice. So, on a morning that was not quite crisp, but at least not stifling, she accepted a case full of directives, locked it to her belt, and climbed aboard one of the regular supply air cars headed for Camp Angleton. She sat on a sack of something lumpy and uncomfortable for 2 hours, the supply air cars had no passenger slings, and watched the red sand brush country give way to dirty green coastal grasslands and then dark green trees standing in brown water. She had only 15 minutes to deliver the directives to the base commander, but 15 minutes of the sticky heat and sulfur stench of the swamp forest was more than enough to quench her curiosity. She was glad to climb back into the air car, now headed for dry lands. The lumpy sack she'd been sitting on had been unloaded along with others, and the crew chief now had room to rig a seat of sorts. That flight took several hours. She fell asleep in the noisy cargo compartment, waking when the air car came down through the late afternoon sun. This far north, a chill wind rattled the few fading leaves left on the trees planted around the base's central drill field, and the short prairie grass had turned various shades of russet and maroon. She handed the base commander his copy of the directives and signed into the TOQ for the night. When she walked around outside, she could almost believe she was on Xavier, until dark, when the night sky looked very different.
Are we really that close to the Scarf?
Next day, she was scheduled for a long-distance flight to the West Coast bases, Big Trees and Dark Harbor. She wondered again who had been allowed to name these places. And then she would embark on the more dangerous journey to the Stack Islands bases. The long-distance flight was not by air car, but in a pressurized aircraft flying much higher than the cars. Beneath her, the land faded into a dim patchwork of dun and wrinkled brown, with white tips on the tall mountains she hoped to see in person someday. Also on the flight were replacement officers and enlisted. She was crammed into her seat with only a brief glimpse through the window whenever the neuro-enhanced Marine beside her leaned back for some reason. Still, it was travel. She had come to learn, and this was learning. She memorized everything she could about the inside of the aircraft. They landed at Big Trees, the runway a long gash in the forest. She had grown up among trees, but they had always had space around and between them. Despite the pictures, she had not really imagined what this forest would be like. Great spires, many times the height of the buildings on the base. After delivering her package to the base commandant, she found she could not get transport to Dark Harbor until the next day. So she wandered out into the afternoon light and up to the margin of the forest. Behind her, mowers trimmed the emerald grass in the quadrangle. Personnel moved from building to building on the walkways. Looking away from all that, she faced a massive dark bowl, like a slightly curved wall. Ferns the height of her head grew near it, trimmed back in a straight line on the base side. Between the chinks of its bark, she thought it must be bark, other plants grew, mosses and ferns and something with bright yellow flowers like tiny fireworks. She edged around the base, following a vague path. Under her feet, the ground felt spongy, and when she had cleared the curve of the great tree's bole, she realized she could not hear the base. The great tree lay between, soaking up the sound. Uneasy in the thick growth, she went back the way she'd come, and then back across the quadrangle to base housing. Her flight up the coast the next morning, again in an air car, revealed how little of the land had been touched by humans. The great forest lay green and unbroken from the base to the foothills of the mountains, and almost all the way to Dark Harbor, where it eased gradually into smaller trees, and then into broken shrubland. In Dark Harbor, she had to wait several days for a transocean flight to the Stack Islands bases. A storm system had moved in, and no one was going to risk a flight during it, not for a mere courier. In the meantime, she was supposed to familiarize herself with cold water ocean survival techniques. It was already early winter in the northern Big Ocean. Margu learned to wriggle into the PPU and fasten the hood with one hand. She went over lifeboat drill and abandoned craft drill at least four separate times. Corporal Asela Martin Jahor stood satellite watch at the remote Blue Islands facility. Unlike Stack Islands, the archipelago known as Blue Islands lay in warm equatorial waters. Assignment to Blue was as coveted as Stack Islands was feared. The big sea predators, which lay in wait for escapees from Stack, were force-netted away from the beautiful white beaches and turquoise lagoons of Blue. All the permanent personnel on planet tried to wangle at least a week's leave time on Blue. Martin Jahor had worked years to earn this assignment, but help from a friend in personnel didn't hurt. He had proven himself time and again. He had recalibrated the number 4 signal array after a sea storm when his senior supervisor was out with gut flu. And, because he showed talent with recalcitrant electronics, he had been permanently assigned to MetSat 4, the weather and surveillance satellite responsible for covering the northern third of Big Ocean. MetSat 4 had been a problem since it was installed. The contractor had replaced it twice, and each time found nothing wrong. The second time, the contractor's project engineer had made the unwelcome suggestion that someone in fleet was screwing up the software. That had been Jarowski, who held the position before Martin Jahor. It hadn't, in fact, been anything Jarowski did, which bollocksed the bird, but in the interest of satisfying the contractor that all steps had been taken, Jarowski had been taken off the roster for MetSat 4. MetSat 4 was still buggy. Martin Jahor was sure it was an AI glitch. So was Jarowski, but Martin Jahor had one vital piece of information Jarowski lacked. The command set for MetSat 4's AI. In theory, every transmission from Blue Islands was logged. In practice, a very good communications tech could tight beam a satellite without detection. Not often, but occasionally. Martin Jahor had chosen his moments carefully, gradually gaining control of MetSat 4's AI at a level no mere communications tech was expected to reach. Now he needed only the cover of a routine test transmission to cause the desired failure. MetSat 4's AI compared the instruction set to those previously received and agreed that they matched in syntax and content. Then it turned off its IR scan and tipped itself 30 degrees around its Z-axis. In the observatory below, one of the dozen screens in satellite surveillance went from a clear visual of a sea storm in progress, a vast swirl of white, to an eye-wrenching, jiggling blaze of hash. Martin Jahor glanced at the screen.
Blast! There goes Watchbird again. I'll bet it's a clock problem.
Nah, it's too random.
Jarowski wasn't going to agree with anything Martin Jahor said. 18 months and he was still sore about losing his place as Watchbird's senior tech.
Well, let's see if C-28 will get it back.
Sometimes Command C-28 would bring Watchbird back online and sometimes it wouldn't. This time it wouldn't, but Martin Jahor punched in that command sequence anyway. The hash on his screens remained.
Not this time.
When C-28 didn't work, the problem usually took longer to fix, but so far, he had always been able to do so.
Try the 43-120 set.
While he could not resist the initial jibe, Jarowski was a generous-hearted man and always willing to help. Martin Jahor nodded and entered it. It wouldn't work either, but it would eat up several minutes while not working. The screen hash changed to a finer grain, but nothing else happened.
Somebody rejuved its AI.
Headquarters might not know about any connection between rejuve and mental problems, but the lower ranks had figured it out long since. As required by regulation, Martin Johor reported to his supervisor that MetSat 4 was ineffective within the hour, when the first three standard interventions didn't bring it back online. CPO Gernock sighed and told him to keep trying. Martin Johor could tell she wasn't really worried. Big Ocean was mostly empty, and the storm MetSat 4 had shown was already in the model. Stack Islands already knew about it. In fact, it was just clearing them now, and it wouldn't reach the mainland for days. MetSat's other capability, that of detecting small craft atmospheric penetration, didn't concern GPO Gernock either. At last report, the only ships in system were, as always, regular space service vessels. A hostile landing would have to come from a hostile deep space ship, and there weren't any. Besides, Polar 1, now at the south end of its orbit, carried sensor arrays designed to spot any intrusive traffic. MetSat 4 was really redundant. Martin Johor knew it was crucial to keep MetSat 4 offline for 5 hours or more. He did not know why, nor did he care. He had convinced himself that it was probably a matter of smuggling something really profitable, given the size of his payoff, and he didn't think smuggling actually hurt anybody. It wasn't his problem if some porn cubes got past customs without paying duty. The attack came on a dank, gray afternoon, with thin rain spitting out of a low sky and visibility just reaching from the parapet of the exercise courtyard to the administrative offices. Gellin Meharry had outside duty and had checked the first three posts when he found that number 4 was missing. Even as he thumbed the control on his comm unit, he felt the prickles rising on his arms. Not at night, after all, but with enough daylight to see if his body caught on any of the rocks.
Fire's here.
Gellin hadn't seriously suspected spires.
Number 4 outside post's empty? Should be Maddow. Has he called in?
No, Corporal. Want me to check sick bay?
Request backup at this post, and run a comm check on the others, would you? Then check sick bay.
Sure thing.
Gellin looked around. Number 4 post gave its occupant a view of the prisoner's exercise court, the entrance block beyond, the upper part of the administrative block overlooking the forecourt, which was itself out of sight, and the peak of the stack itself rising beyond that. To his left, he could see the helmet of number 3 post. To his right and down, on the outside of the entrance block, he should have seen the bright dot that was number 5. He didn't. He leaned out over the parapet of number 4 to check the path below. There, far below, a bright yellow splotch and a white dot near it.
Spires, this is Corporal Meharry again. There's a man down on the west side path. Have you raised number 5 yet?
No, Corporal. Sergeant says he's on the way. You want me to call medical?
Better do it. I'll go down and see.
As the blow fell, he lunged forward so that his skull took less than the intended blow. The unexpectedness of that lunge loosened his captor's grip, and he got in another good shove as he went over the edge. For an instant, hanging in the air with the sea spread out below him, he was euphoric. They hadn't knocked him out. His plan would work. Then he was close enough to see the height of the waves, mere wrinkles from above, here taller than he was, and smashing into the sharp rocks. He plunged into water so cold it took his breath, with force enough to nearly knock him out. He fought his way to the surface by blind instinct, helped by the surge of the rising tide. When he shook the water from his eyes, he saw a black wall rushing toward him, covered with sharp shells. He threw out his arms. The water slammed him into the rock with crushing force, but the PPU gloves protected his hands and then his body from the sharp edges of the shells, and the wrist grapples locked onto the surface. When the water dragged back, he was able to stay on the rock. In that brief second, he curled up, jamming his boots into a crack, and deployed the PPU's lower grapples. The grapples held, his arms and legs strained. As a wave receded, he released the wrist grapples, flung himself upward, and locked the wrists again, just as the next wave hit. Minute by minute, he fought his way upward, racing the tide and the limits of his own strength. Distant clamor battered his hearing, even over the roar and suck of the waves. He looked upward, only to get a faceful of cold water. Just above high tide, well within the splash zone, he clung to the rock. Despite the PPU, he was chilled. Without it, he would have been dead. He could feel his arms and legs stiffening from both cold and bruising, and out there somewhere, the killers were looking for him. Gellin stripped off the last of his duty uniform, ripping it free with the grapple claws of the PPU. He hoped it would look like the damage of sea creatures if the killers spotted it. Underneath, the PPU's programmable outer surface took on the mottled dark color of the rock. Now, if they looked down, they would see only rock, not a splash of yellow. He unhooked and unrolled the hood and pulled it over his head. At once, he felt better. The hood cut the wind chill. He sealed it close around his face, then pulled up the face mask. The last bite of the wind disappeared. He wasn't comfortable, but he was no longer in danger of hypothermia. Not soon, anyway. He touched the controls on his chest, and the PPU's circuitry delivered a boosted audio signal. Another control released a fine antenna to pick up transmissions.
Went over right there, sir. No chance to grab him. And he went right down. Maybe he hit his head on a rock.
Darkness closed in early. Gellin could see lights above. He waited until they were gone, then longer. They would be scanning in infrared as well. Though his suit reflected almost all his body heat inward to protect him from the cold, a sensitive scan could pick up a human shape in movement. But well after local midnight, he moved, stiffly at first, then more smoothly, toward the lava tube where, he hoped, his survival kit was still concealed. Once in the mouth of the tube, he risked a brief flash of his torch. There it was. And there was Commander Bakarian, a weapon leveled at his chest.
I thought they might have underestimated you. I didn't.
Gellin stared at the weapon.
I will be glad to take your ears. I might even send one to your family.
The thought of Methlin's reaction if she got one of her little brother's ears in the mail made him grin in spite of his fear.
Do that. Yes!
Gellin dove toward her. Gellin pivoted on one suit grapple and slammed both booted feet into her side. He felt the crunch of bone, but she wasn't dead. She would have more than one weapon. He scrambled towards her, raking with the suit grapples. A thin red beam appeared, the rangefinder of her next weapon. Gellin felt something with one glove and yanked hard. Something slammed into his shoulder. Gellin swung elbows, knees, feet, and took hard blows himself, barely softened by the suit. Then the blows weakened. He hit again and again. Gellin didn't know if she was dead or feigning, or if she had been alone. He fumbled around, trying to find the torch, but finally gave up and used the suit's headlamp. His suit grapples glistened, brilliant red in the light. He had torn her face off in that last struggle. An ear dangled from one grapple tip. He shook it free.
She took ears. I am a Mahari.
He was a Mahari who had killed an officer. An officer who was, as far as anyone knew, his legitimate superior merely doing her duty. He couldn't just go tell the sergeant about it. Not this time.
Methlin said there would be days like this.
She had never told him he might have to murder his commander and then figure out how to explain it. He needed to search Bakarian's body. Surely, if she intended some serious wrongdoing, beyond having him killed, she would have some evidence on her. She would not trust everything to an office safe. But not here, not where her confederates might be on their way, alerted by some signal he knew nothing about, or simply by her failure to show up at a meeting. If she had evidence on her, he would have to take her corpse along, or they would destroy it.
Storm coming?
He couldn't wait. Gellin dragged the life raft down the tube to the lip, and then considered what to do with Bakarian's body. Finally, he decided to bring it along. It was heavier than he expected, awkward to heave and tip into the raft, but he secured it carefully before shifting the raft, and himself, to the very edge of the rock. A more violent gust of wind caught it and whirled it through the air to land hard on the water. Gellin almost lost his hold. Even through the PPU, he could feel the water's chill and its power. He yanked the vent control, and the raft ballooned around him. Bakarian's body lurched into him as the raft whirled, tilted, whirled again on the wild waves.